осуществлен государственный переворот в его прямой.
Здесь встать на баррикадах и у...
Я умоляю боевых товарищей, кто меня слышит, немедленно на помощь всем
народам. Российские правительные силы начинают штурмовать здание парламента в Москве.
Все, кто с оружием в руках.
It lasted less than 2 weeks. It ended with the worst street violence Moscow had seen since 1917, and it set off a series of political precedents that endure to this day. 20 years ago this week, Russian President Boris Yeltsin ordered the army to shell and storm the country's parliament, the Supreme Soviet, bringing a violent end to his bitter conflict with the country's legislature. At the time, many liberals cheered, arguing that with the retrograde hardline parliament vanquished, Russia could finally get on with the task of building a functioning democracy. Instead, in the end, they got the opposite. Were the events of the fall of 1993 post-Soviet Russia's original sin? Were the seeds of today's authoritarian power vertical planted 2 decades ago? Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from London is co-host Kirill Kobrin, editor of the history and sociology magazine NZ. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
And also on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russia's security services and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome back, Mark.
Hey there.
And also joining us via Skype and also from New York City is Nina Khrushcheva, a professor of international affairs at the New School, director of the Russian program at the World Policy Institute, whose latest book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind, will be out next spring. Welcome back, Nina.
Thank you.
Russia has a super presidency and a toothless legislature. The expectation is that the rule of law will always be trumped by a much older principle, might makes right. The Siloviki play an outsized role in politics. There's a tendency for the executive branch to massage, manipulate, and change the rules of the game at will. But these aren't bugs in Russia's political operating system. They are features. And one could look at this in 2 ways, I think. On October 4th, 1993, it set the stage for these tendencies to develop and grow. It was the day post-Soviet Russia lost its innocence, fell from grace. It's the day the infant democratic experiment, if you will, was strangled in the cradle, to paraphrase Churchill. Another way to look at it is October 4th, 1993 was the day that post-Soviet Russia simply reverted back to its old Soviet form. Either way, I think you can draw a direct line from these events 2 decades ago to Vladimir Putin's power vertical today in many ways. Nina, let's start with you. What are your thoughts?
I think you're right. We certainly can have 20 years of history drawn back to 1993. I would say that Russia was never innocent, and so therefore never lost it, or probably was innocent in the 11th century.
Would you allow that there was this brief period, late perestroika, the early post-Soviet period, where there, maybe innocence is too strong a word, but there was a chance.
But that's what's so interesting about Russian history. It always has a chance, and it always sort of blows that chance, because it always goes back to something that you said in your introduction that might trump Seoul. And ultimately, when one leader succeeds another, but the formula of power remains the same, it always comes from the top, you just have no other choice. Of course, you have a choice, but you have no other option than just to rebuild or continue to rebuild the same vertical of power. So it wasn't that it wasn't innocent. It's just it always gives up very quickly because, dictatorships are in some ways a much easier form of governance because you tell people what to do and then you kill them if they don't do it. So that's what Russia's predicament is. I don't know if it's innocence. It's the predicament because it tries other versions but then goes back to what it is, to something comes from the Kremlin and everybody else stay in line.
So you would be of the mind that Russia reverted to form on this day and after rather than losing its innocence, and as I suggested might have been the case as well.
Well, I'm just saying that, you know, when you are new democratically elected president is the former party apparatchik, you would have those kind of
concerns.
issues, just because that's what he knows and that's what he does. And even with all the promises that the Yeltsin era gave to us, at the time it was still very Leninist run, because even the greatest economic reformers like Igor Gaidar and whatnot, they were using the Leninist formulas. Mm-hmm. They were telling everybody what to do and then expecting everybody to do that. And it was always done in that kind of Avral manner, in a manner that we have to achieve great results in 5 seconds or less, or something else would happen. So basically, once again, Russia didn't give itself enough time. It wanted to achieve democracy in 5 minutes. And I remember one of those reformers said that, you know, in 3 years, we achieved something that the rest of the world spent 300 years achieving. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a Russian problem, and that brings the vertical of power.
Yeah.
Back the vertical of power.
In an interview with RFRL's Russian service last week, Sergei Filatov, who was Yeltsin's chief of staff at the time, said, we, and I'm paraphrasing, but he said, we all had this Soviet mentality. We all had this Soviet sickness. Yeltsin, the legislature had it, but Yeltsin also had it. And then the money quote was, and we haven't learned a thing in 20 years.
And we do, because Yeltsin had Soviet mentality and now Putin has Soviet mm-hmm. mentality. So in a sense, it is this 20 years that were a great promise. And I'm sure there are some steps forward have been made, but at the same time, this promise faltered once again.
Well, and I'm very curious to see now this generation that's coming up now, people in their 20s, people that have no memory of the USSR. If they will be any different, or if this will be kind of if the traditions of all the dead generations really do weigh like a nightmare on the brain of the living, as Marx wrote. Mark, what are your thoughts going from Marx to Mark?
Good company. In many ways, I think that the issue was not so much the shelling of a rather disagreeable and disreputable legislature. However, you know, obviously sort of traumatic an event that was, that could conceivably have been a cleansing act. Unconstitutional, violent, but nonetheless, there was the possibility that could have been we still have this hangover from Soviet times. It is an anachronism. It is politically dangerous. We need to do something about it. But then we will, as it were, consider this to be the democratic year zero. It is now, not 1991 or 1992, that is the key point at which we start. However, Yeltsin decided to rewrite the constitution, to basically hyper-presidentialize it, and it retrospectively allow what he had done. Because technically, as soon as he turned against parliament, he was no longer president. He didn't hold early elections as a way of, basically arranging a proper mandate for his post-1993
as he had promised
order.
To do on September 21st, when he announced the decree, he said there will be presidential elections as well as parliamentary elections.
Precisely. I mean, this is it. I mean, he didn't sort of follow up on those. And the third element is more general, and it speaks to this sort of terrible rush that the quote-unquote reformers had, is that they were so terrified about the notion of the return of communists that everything had to be sacrificed to that. We also saw that within the economy. This ghastly shock therapy, which is basically aimed at moving swaths of the national economy into private hands, regardless of whose hands they were. So on the whole, it was, you know, oligarchs, corrupt politicians, organized crime, or whatever. That principle that any private hands is better than state hands because we're worried about the communists coming back. That fear that there would be some kind of communist revanchism was such that it drove them. We can call it strangling the infant democracy in its cradle. We can call it returning to the Soviet past. Really, they're just two faces of the same coin. But for me, the big deal was not so much the shelling of parliament, but creating a new post-Supreme Soviet order. And that, for me, is definitely, as you put it, the original sin.
Kirill, what do you think?
I'd like to focus on the details of so-called innocence. I'm not sure that Russia, you know, lost innocence during this bloody, in all meanings of this word, events. First of all, what do we mean by the word innocence in this particular historical case? It's a combination, a very strange combination of a very naive Marxist idea that the economy is a foundation of the political structure and public mind of the society. And secondly, a very strong neoliberal, very plain and very, in some sense, naive ideas that it's better if property and all industry and all in economy will be in the private hands. It's a very strange combination of Marxism and neoliberalism. That was Russian the so-called democratic innocence in the very beginning of 1990s. And that was a pattern of mind of all so-called young reformers and at the same time Yeltsin. And all this illusion was, of course, destroyed by the events of 1993 because the authorities, Yeltsin himself, just understood that the population and part of the political elite is not happy of these reforms, and it's not, you know, such a quick revolutionary and enthusiastically support Nina. So Leninist switch to some, you know,
to the other side, basically.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And that was the initial point of a so-called new Russia, not Putinism and so on, but a so-called new Russian, you know, political consciousness, which is not such naive. And that's very important. If we can speak about any, you know, real innocence, political innocence about, you know, so-called democratic authorities, Yeltsin himself and so on. So I'll name another event. I say about the presidential election of 1996. That was the initial point of Putinism, not the events of 1993. It was, you know, everything got absolutely clear after 1993. About all these illusions of the combination of Marxist ideas and neoliberal attitude to economy. But there were still a lot of illusions about Yeltsin himself and all, you know, this so-called democratic political elite.
So you're saying that Russia never was truly innocent, basically. And, you know, I use that as a figure of speech. I'm not naive enough to think Russia was ever will be, or if anybody for that matter ever was or will be completely.
We can speak about illusions, but not about innocence. That are, you know, two different things. Absolutely.
There's a couple of precedents that I thought were set back in this time period two decades ago. I wrote about them on the blog a little bit that I posted to preview this podcast. One of them goes to something Mark had talked about here, the Yeltsin's decision not to hold early presidential elections. He originally was going to have elections in June of 1994, if that was the plan. And he pushed them back to the end of the term he was elected to in 91. That would be June of 96. In this set, what I think is an important precedent of just changing the rules of the game in midstream. And I think you can almost draw a direct line from that to things like, you know, Yeltsin's surprise New Year's Eve resignation back in 1999, just fixing the game to get his chosen successor in there. You can trace the castling and just this whole idea of just like, you know, yeah, we got these rules we're supposed to pretend we play by, but we can just move the pieces around the board and you know, play a little three-card Monty here and get the result we want. What are everybody's thoughts on that? Do you see this to tracing back to that time? I mean, it probably goes farther back, but it became part of the DNA at that time is what it seems to me. Nina, what do you think?
But actually, I think it's not tracing back to that time. Once again, it's tracing back to forever because Russia doesn't follow rules. Russia is 11 time zones. Well, now 9. Russia can do things that others cannot do. It's big. It's powerful. It can flex its muscle. It has this super presidency or superpower. And sort of that goes with the territory. So I wouldn't say that it traces back to 93, but it's certainly almost in zoology, you smell blood and then you just go with it, because I think Kirill mentioned 96, and I completely agree with him. When we're all upset with Putin's nominating Medvedev or coming back in 2012, yeah. In 96 was the same thing. All of a sudden, we were told that if we don't elect Yeltsin, there's going to be war between Ukraine and Russia. Which, by the way, was not happening, and yet we were told that.
I was told there'd be no food. I remember signs on stores saying, buy food now, it may be your last chance.
Exactly. And I remember Igor Gaidar had 6 points that he very articulately explained to us why we needed to vote with a heart rather than the brain, or the other way around. I forgot
which was
what
a was. Very poor metaphor, if we remember what was going on at that time with Yeltsin.
Very, but then we also have to remember in 94, all of a sudden, that democratic Russia and Yeltsin, who said that you have to, sovereignty is important, you all go and become your own countries, all of a sudden he goes into Chechnya and starts all these bloody wars that have been going on for 200 plus years. So it's really not that new. I think the shock was, and I completely agree with Kirill, there was illusions, and all of a sudden those illusions were gone, and then we had to justify them. And we've been justifying them until 99, when Yeltsin finally said, oh, I quit, because if I don't, something else would happen. And he was right. So he negotiated that. But it's really not that original, because Russian leaders, Soviet leaders, czars before them, they changed the rule of the games for the benefit of their own power. That's what your vertical of power back is again.
But this was the beginning of when we had this thing that looked like a democracy on paper. But yet it was a managed democracy, a sovereign democracy, to use Surkov's terms. This was when Russia's always been stretching the rules, so to speak. But here there was, after 91, there was this recognition that there are rules. And, you know, we're going to, and there was a stated the intention of those who came to power after the coup of August 91, that we are going to play by these democratic rules. And starting from the events of 93, I think, they began to, the democratic experiment became managed democracy at that point. It became, you know, upravляемая демократия. It was the Surkov version. And, you know, Surkov wasn't even in the Kremlin quite yet, or maybe he was. But this is when I kind of see this starting. Before that, you had the sense that they were trying. Mark, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I would say, I mean, first of all, I'm a little concerned about a sort of sense of historical determinism that could otherwise sort of creep in here about, you know, well, this has always been the way Russia is. I mean, all powers seek to squeeze their way round rules or whatever. And in some ways, ironically enough, the Soviet order was actually a bit more institutionalized and constrained than the Yeltsin order. You know, if you look at leaders like Brezhnev and Gorbachev, they actually had far more institutional constraints within the political system than Yeltsin. I mean, Yeltsin
or certainly
had that
Putin.
Opportunity. Well, and here's another, here's a slightly polemical point. One could make the case that Putin is more democratic than Yeltsin. First of all, I mean, you've got to think about it. Yeltsin was very much a heavy-handed local party boss who was brought to Moscow. He was never really a democrat. Because the other irony is, I mean, Putin, despite all the use of administrative resources and massaging the results, you know, I think it does seem fairly clear that he has won the elections on which he's based his mandate. Now, we all know all the various limitations around that. But compare that with actually Yeltsin's victory in 1996, which was much more clearly a stolen one.
Well, I think he won the election, but I think he probably, they massaged the vote for sure. But I don't think Zhuganov won that election.
I think to call that massage, I think he's sort of wandering into red light district territory, of the kind of massage as we're talking about. But anyway, I mean, I don't want to make this about sort of Putin versus Yeltsin, but I just wanted to sort of throw that out. We have a tendency otherwise to think of this as some kind of declining curve, and I'm not quite sure. But the one point I would make about this whole issue is yes, The problem is that Russia's new democrats thought that democracy was essentially about structures. Now, actually, the most important thing about democracy is a willingness for power to subordinate itself to law.
Process.
Yeah. That is actually what matters rather than whether or not you have votes, whether or not you have plural media and all that kind of thing. And just as within the economy, they seem to think that actually a free market just simply means people buying and selling rather than thinking about the trust, the constraints and so forth.
The rules
actually
of the game.
Make a market real. Well, the rules of the game is, I mean, I think it's rules of law.
Mm.
I think that's the key thing, because exactly, games are, you know, shift and mutate. But the whole point is subordinating yourself to law is the most important real aspect of democratic values. And that was something that was never internalized. And on that point, I would agree with Nina. That is something that has, you know, a deep tradition within Russia, as it had once upon a time in all countries. But if we look at sort of working democracies, they have worked their way through that. Russia never has.
Can I jump in?
Yes, of course. I was going to about to...
Mark, I disagree with you. And I do love that, you know, that you always can rely on Anglo-Saxons to point out other countries went through this and Russia will too. And I absolutely agree with that. We will. It's just, I think that Russian desire to constantly skip certain stages of development, that really worries me. I mean, and that whole, I mean, you mentioned economics and neoliberalism, which I thought was a very appropriate comment that you made earlier, is that not another great economic reformer, Anatoly Chubais, indeed said that we finally built capitalism by 2000, I think he said. We built capitalism and the rest of the world spent 300 years achieving. So that worries me. And I think that brings a bit of a historical determinism, is that Russia really doesn't take time to go through legalistic manners to figure out how rules work, to institutionalize things. I mean, and you were completely completely right that Yeltsin was, to a degree, well, lesser institutionalized leader than Putin is. I wouldn't call him a less of a democrat, because neither were. And Yeltsin was simply the czar of Russian democracy. I mean, that's what he was, and in all his incarnations, and Putin kind of a manager of it, which is a different and more institutionalized formula. But the problem is that we just don't, I mean, we in Russia, Russians, we don't take the time to figure out how these things actually work for the society. So the state develops, but society, because of that, really doesn't as much.
I recall a joke that was popular in Moscow back in 91, and, you know, what is communism? It's a historical stage of development in between capitalism and capitalism. But if you look below the hood there, basically, that's assuming that in 1916, Russia had capitalism, which, I mean, it's a stretch. And it's assuming that in 91 they had it, which
it
is more
promise.
Than a stretch.
It has a promise. And right. Then it kind of goes back to what it knows best, which is ruling by decree. And Yeltsin was one of the most decree-ruling presidents.
Well, no, I remember one thing Yuri Bolotov said during the Yeltsin presidency is that these guys look at democracy as meaning keep us Democrats in power. That was indeed the mentality. Mark, a chance to respond, and then I'll move on to Kirill.
Yeah, I'm, again, maybe it's my Anglo-Saxonness, though. I would note that I'm half Italian, so clearly I don't have entirely functioning democratic DNA. I mean, I think, look, every country looks for shortcuts. You know, no national elite on creating acquiring power suddenly says, well, let's think in terms of how we can create working democratic values in the next 200 years. The thing about Russia, and I think in some ways what I do think is distinctive here, is precisely because the quote-unquote Democrats came to power under the shadow of communism. In effect, they felt that they were on a political war footing, and no country that feels itself at war tends to be that effective a working democracy. It doesn't matter, you know... Even the most democratic country basically becomes an authoritarian socialism when it's at war. And therefore, I think that was one of the key issues. If you think of this sort of parallel, neither did the Communist Party sufficiently collapse in terms of its sort of structures on the ground, its actual grasp of power in 1991 that the Democrats could feel safe. But on the other hand, nor was it unified enough that it actually represented a body that could meaningfully challenge the Yeltsin order. I mean, you know, the rather ridiculous, you know, quote-unquote sort of revolution of 1993, you know, was not in any way something that, that was ever going to sort of seize the Kremlin, let alone power. So, I mean, I think in some ways Russia was a victim of a very specific historical situation that a whole bunch of very poor choices then turned into a long-term tragedy.
Kirill, I actually wanted you to jump in on this because you've been silent for a little while. Uncharacteristically
<That's>
so.
Not, as a trained historian, I'm a little bit suspicious to historical determinism. And I'd like to introduce another, you know, way of thinking, maybe more anarchist, more individualist, maybe in some sense more Buddhist, Leo Tolstoyan view on history. When we think about, you know, the capitalism or the model of capitalism, which had been imported to Russia in the very beginning of 1990s, I ever think about what capitalism, what kind of capitalism had been imported, firstly, and secondly, what capitalism, you know, what does it mean? The very system, the very word, the very term, capitalism is an ethical system, first of all. It's an ethical system because this is a political and economical consequence of the very idea of the personal choice.
You could say the same thing about democracy.
Yes. And that's why the very idea of capitalism and democracy is so connected in the public mind. That's why it's connected. Of course, I don't want to mention, you know, Max Weber and all these, you know, brilliant thinkers who wrote about the Protestant ethic of capitalism and so on. But my point is that they, Yeltsin, Chubais, Gaidar, whoever, they try to import capitalism without it, and democracy at the same time, without its, you know, moral
foundation.
Meaning. Yes, and ethical foundation. I'm not preaching, of course. I'm not Solzhenitsyn and so on. But that was but that was a very important thing because when everyone speaks about the Russian 1990s, the first word is, you know, first definition is chaotic, and the second definition is immoral.
Mm.
It's very interesting that the golden era of Russian capitalism is absolutely connected with the term, you know, immoral, with the immoralism.
When was the golden era of Russian capitalism?
In 1990s, of course, when, you know, ask all these, you know, people who now are in the ranks of democratic opposition to Putin and so on, and they will say that, okay, there were some, you know, some very unpleasant things in 1990s, but anywhere that
before
was
98.
Yes, that was before 1998. That was, you know, the best period in post-Soviet history, and that was my first point. And second point, I'd like to follow the Marx idea about institutions and to change somehow. The problem is that if you are imported the democracy, not as an idea but as a system, you must focus on their democratic institutions. If you want really to import this, like, you know, Peter the Great imported, you know, Western way of life and so on, he was very interested in constructing the institution, even on the, you know, on the local level. Remember all his administrative reforms and so on. That was one of the most important and grave failures of Yeltsin's policy. He never thought about the local institutional level of his own country. And now we have, you know, the consequences of this. Because, of course, even the so-called power vertical now is, you know, it's like flying island Laputo in Jonathan Swift's, you know, Gulliver Adventures, because it has no an institutional foundation. That's very important.
In October, on October 4th, 93, the institutions were obliterated, literally, before our eyes in Moscow.
But what kind of the institutions? You know, this old-style Verkhovny Soviet and so on, that was not, and you know, they didn't fit the very idea of democracy and so on. Because, don't forget, Verkhovny Soviet, the very idea of Soviety, mm-hmm. yes? That was absolutely different from the democratic idea of the, you know, different branches of power. Soviety, it's Lenin's idea, yeah? And an example of, historical example of Soviety is French Convent during mm-hmm. the Great the French Revolution. It's absolutely different from the very idea, Anglo-Saxon, by the way, idea of the division of the branches.
Again with the Anglo-Saxon.
Yeah.
All right, well, in a few moments, we'll continue our discussion of those fateful events 2 decades ago and their legacy, and examine a question that many were asking at the time. Was the whole thing a provocation? I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFARL. Joining me on the Skype line from London is co-host Kirill Kobrin, editor of the History and Sociology magazine, NZ. And also on the Skype line from New York City is Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. And also joining us from Skype and also from New York City is Nina Khrushcheva, professor of international affairs at the New School and director of the Russian program at the World Policy Institute, whose book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind, will be published next spring. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfurl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. It wouldn't be Russia if there wasn't a conspiracy theory or two in the mix. And as soon as the smoke cleared from the storming of the White House, they came out fast and furious, appearing in popular broadsheets like Moskovsky Komsomolets. There were agent provocateurs among the anti-Yeltsin protesters to attack the Astankino television station in the Moscow mayor's office on the night of October 3rd, events that precipitated and gave legitimacy to Yeltsin's decision to use force. Interior Ministry troops reduced their numbers around the two buildings, essentially allowing people to mob and storm them and walk into a trap and then give the Kremlin the pretext to storm the parliament. The whole thing, the argument went, was an elaborate setup. I can't help but recall a conversation I had in Moscow with sociologist Boris Kagarlitsky back in September 1999 during the apartment bombings when I asked Boris, you know, do you think there's a conspiracy going on here? And Boris smiled and looked at me and said, Brian, how long have you lived here? In Russia, the right question never is there a conspiracy? The question always is which conspiracy is in fact succeeding? And it wasn't just the tinfoil hat crowd who were pushing this back in 1993. Bruce Clark, for example, the Moscow bureau chief of the Times of London, now a senior editor at The Economist, wrote about it in his book, An Empire's New Clothes, The End of the Russian Liberal Dream. So did Jonathan Steele in The Guardian and others. Mark, you're our expert on spooks and criminals and Siloviki and all other things shady and conspiratorial. I'm sure you've seen and evaluated this version of events. Could this have been a provocation, an elaborate setup, a conspiracy? If not one ordered from the top, at least one hatched among the elements in the security services. At the very least, there appears to be some dramaturgia afoot here, if not a conspiracy. What do you think, Mark?
There's basically two principles that I tend to hold to. One is that cock-up tends to be much more prevalent than conspiracy, even in Russia. And second thing is everything leaks. I mean, I know I tell the students on my intelligence class that they should take as their role model the Hell's Angels with their dictum that two can keep a secret if one of them is dead. In that context, I mean, I think there are two things worth saying. I mean, first of all, in 20 years, we've not had one single serious account come out of someone who was involved in any such conspiracy or witnessed any such conspiracy to prove, for example, that the movements of the interior troops that seem to have been sort of clearing the way were more than just shift changes or just bad management of forces in a very confusing time. And the second thing is, If this had been some kind of conspiracy, then one would have expected the conspirators to have had their forces ready. But in fact, if you look at it, there was all kinds of horse trading to get troops from the Kantemir and Tamanskaya divisions to be willing to involve themselves. The Alpha counter-terrorist commando group that clearly would have been the spearhead, well, at first, that actually refused to get involved. It only got involved when one of their members got shot by a defender from the White House. Now, okay, one could push that through to a Yeltsinite sniper provocateur, but that's, I think, beginning to move definitely into that tin foil hat territory. So, I mean, in that context, I mean, I think this was just Yeltsin doing what Yeltsin did best, which is exploiting an opportunity to destroy his enemies. I mean, this is the thing about Yeltsin. He was phenomenally effective and focused when he had an enemy. It was precisely when he didn't have an enemy, when actually he had power and opportunity and could have done something to create a new Russia, that's when he lost focus and tended to sort of fall back on, to be blunt, the pills and the booze. I don't see this as a conspiracy, though I can understand why people would be thinking that. Instead, I think what it says is precisely that what had emerged after the collapse of the Soviet Union was an entirely untenable situation. There was going to be some kind of a spark, as it was Khasbulat, Vrutskoy and so forth were foolish enough to... And here, I think, you know, if one looks at whether it's dramaturgia or conspiracy or whatever, I think there was an element in which they were being pushed because precisely it suited the Kremlin to present the Supreme Soviet as essentially a kind of a combination of lunatics and dinosaurs. And they obliged. But that, I think, is probably the limit to the kind of the conspiratorial nature of this process. Something was going to happen that was going to lead to a clash. It didn't have to involve tanks in the middle of Moscow, but there would have been some kind of a clash. Right.
I mean, you can believe that the Interior Ministry troops did pull back in their defenses of Ostankino, and you can believe there were maybe provocateurs among the anti-Yeltsin protesters. You can believe all these things, and there doesn't have to necessarily have to be a grand conspiracy afoot. I still haven't really concluded what I think about this. I'm still not satisfied that I have all the facts of what went on that day. Nina, what do you think?
Can I just make one very brief observation? I mean, the problem is that actually, if one was just looking at, let's say, Interior Ministry troop movements, then you could just simply say, aha, it was the head of the Moscow Commendatura or whatever. But actually, if you put together, it would have to be something that includes Interior Ministry troop commanders, police commanders, military commanders, mm-hmm. and Alpha. Because in a way, the conspiracy depends on bits of all of those. Now, frankly, as soon as you're talking about that, you are actually having to talk about some kind of real conspiracy.
Right. And at the end of the day, Rutskoy did stand on the balcony of the White House and urge people to go to the mayor's office and to Ostankino. Khasbulatov urged them to go to the Kremlin. So it's and I'm not really sure I'm willing to include them all in the conspiracy as well. Nina, although they both were amnestied a year later. Nina, what are your dramaturgia, conspiracy?
I actually think that Mark's analysis is fantastic. I mean, honestly, I haven't heard a better explanation of how it could be this, but it also could be just the forces of events that did happen. So there's a bit of chaos, but also somewhat orchestrated chaos, because if we look back to our vertical that we've been discussing and look back at the top of it, which is Yeltsin was indeed fantastic in figuring out how to pit people against each other, pit forces against each other to keep himself as quote-unquote, the only solution to Russia's democracy. And I was actually in the streets in Moscow in October 1993, and I did see it happen. Some probably were provocateurs, and there were more and more people, but also, you know, I teach propaganda, so you do know that the crowd actually gets excited. It doesn't have to be necessarily a specific conspiracy, but then you fall into one form of thinking or into another, and then you end up really having clashes. And so that's exactly, I think, what happened. So I think the scenario part was there, but imagining that it was some deep, well-orchestrated thing, it wasn't. It was just really that kind of Yeltsin's luck. He was great at that. He was great at standing on the tank. He was great at crisis. He was great at saying, well, I lead you to the better future because there's all these communists who are standing in your way. And so I think Mark, I mean, it's just really very little to add. I hope there is an article or book coming from Mark on that subject. I would really like to read it.
Kirill, I assume you hate conspiracy theories as much as you hate historical analogies, so I'm going to give you the microphone for that.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I'm the only defender of the common sense in this world, yeah.
In this world?
Yes.
Not
yes.
Even on this podcast, come on.
No.
It is Russian grandiosity.
Yes, I'm joking, of course. But from the point of view of common sense, of course, all these conspiracy theories about post-Soviet politics is a little bit funny because all these things are too sophisticated for this political elite. Too sophisticated. You must be, you know, you must take care of everything if you want to plot something, you know, to make a conspiracy, to elaborate all the details and so on. All the, you know, Russian politicians whom I know, but not, of course, personally, but, you know, I observe... I'm observing them for a long time, they are absolutely unable to do these things, firstly. And I'm absolutely agree with Mark and Nina about this point. Secondly, from the another, you know, point of view, let's look at the events of 1993 from, you know, again, I just already mentioned Leo Tolstoy, from Tolstoy's point of view. What Tolstoy would speak about these events? Of course, it's an chaotic event of, you know, several crowds in Moscow. And that's all. With, the, you know, all this mass psychology, with all the impulses, with all the improvisations, with all these, you know, things. That's how he, you know, he described patriotic war in the beginning of 19th century and so on. And I completely agree with him. Of course, when you looked, when you observed all these events, you will see all these, you know, crowds which are storming Ostankino or fighting in the Moscow streets and so on. You'll see that that was an irrational burst of hate, of political and even personal hate. And that is the answer. I think there are a lot of examples. I'm not so, you know, experienced in Latin American history, but I think there are a lot of such events in history, say, you know, of Argentina or Mexico and so on.
Nina, you, as you said, were in Moscow at the time. I was in Odessa, actually. I watched it on Ostankino as long as I could. But you were and listened to the BBC, but you were in Moscow at the time.
I was in Moscow.
What did you see? What did you feel? What did it feel like? Did you feel like you were in a place that was on the verge of civil war, or what did it feel like?
You know, it was actually very interesting because it lasted days. So we started going out and sort of figuring out what's going on. And there were very small crowds originally, either next to the White House or to the Kremlin. There were not that many people in the streets. And then one day, 2 days, and all of a sudden it just was turning into this battle of who supports whom and how they support and what's going on. And, you know, police was trying to stop you if you are going in the wrong direction. So it does seem that, I mean, in this, I wouldn't go that far with, but certainly some sort of a scenario or some sort of knowledge of how, please forgive me, Russian history works, is that, or any history for that matter, because you can really start a revolution by strategically, you know, spouting certain slogans. And I think Kirill really put it very well. It sort of hates appears. You don't even need to hate anybody, but once you become part of the group, then you have to take sides. And so the sides were taken. For example, you mentioned at the beginning the Russian intelligentsia, the Moscow intelligentsia, who should be on the side of the institutions and against the shelling. Right. Remember Bulat Okudžava, the greatest symbol of freedom, was actually speaking and speaking for Yeltsin's decision, and they were writing letters supporting Yeltsin go kill those communists. And I think these words were also very important. Mm. So in some ways, once again, as Mark so well said, no pressure, so well said, that all these groups, even maybe not in cohorts, but they do create a certain environment, and that's what the feeling was. And then when it culminated in the shelling, I was actually surprised, because then I did think it was a conspiracy, because it didn't seem that it should get to this. I didn't think that, I didn't think Russia was innocent ever, but there was a hope, and it was sort of slightly shocking that Yeltsin would revert to such clearly non-democratic forms of doing it. Not that I was surprised, but at least I sort of slightly expected better from it. So in a sense, I mean, it really, once again, back to Mark's description, I think that's exactly how it happened. It's one, well, those, the orchestrated chaos that brought to that decision with final non-democratic decision, as Russians often do, is that, well, we actually have to use force, otherwise we're just going to, our power is going to collapse, and the most thing that is important to us is to stay in power.
And to stay alive in this case. I
mean, and to stay
free or alive.
I think it was more power for them. I don't know if Yeltsin was expected to get killed.
If Rutskoy and Hasbulatov came to, one never knows. Before we wrap up, last words on any of this anybody would like to add? Somebody must.
I just want to agree with Nina that actually the shelling of the White House was definitely significant. Once he'd mastered the streets, Yeltsin could have just starved and negotiated the defenders out. But again, if we're talking about dramaturgy as much as anything else, he wanted a dramatic, a spectacular.
And this is where the conspiracy comes in.
Yeah, exactly. But again, I think you don't have to have a conspiracy to just simply think, okay, I'm in this situation. What is going to be the best use of this? And this is why I think this is, for me, the whole issues of October 1993 are why the true political epitaph to Yeltsin that I wish could have been sort of carved on that sprawling Russian flag of a gravestone of his is Yeltsin was a destroyer, never a creator. He just happened to be very good at that.
Mm-hmm. Kirill?
When I think about these events, I was in Nizhny Novgorod at that time and was following all this, crisis, watching TV and listening to the radio. That was before the internet era. And, and when I think about all these events now, I always remember a famous picture, which you can find on one of the corridors of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, just near Russian service. It's one of the best photographs which I ever, saw in my life, explaining the very mechanism of the public unrest and, a serious political events. We can see a tank which is shelling White House. White House is burning. But that is a background. And on this background, we can see two smiling guys, like tourists. They're just smiling and looking very happy because, of course, though the picture is great.
Yes.
And they didn't care about all these things. And living that time in a Russian province, I can speak that, I think 90% of Russian population just didn't care about all these things which happened that time in Moscow.
No, I was actually, I was watching, as I wrote the blog that set up this podcast, I was looking at an interview with Boris Nemtsov, who looked impossibly young as the governor of Nizhny Novgorod at the time. He was 33. This was all in the context of a larger documentary done about how Nizhny Novgorod during these events. And people were going to a concert in the Philharmonia and didn't even really know what was going on. And that kind of symbolized it for me. I guess what you're just saying seems to confirm that.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yes, that's true. And that's the very important thing which we must think about when we speak about such events. That was, of course, that was crucial event for Russian state and democracy and whatever, but that was not an important thing for 90% of Russian population. That's, that's the problem.
Nina, last word to you. If you want it.
Since I was in Moscow, actually, it was the event. Right. And in this, I do agree with you that a lot of things were lost because So that was the shelling was the first step. Yeltsin was a destroyer, not a creator. Then Chechnya happened. Yeltsin was a destroyer, not a creator. 96, that the elections went from 1% of his popularity to whatever he wanted on 52 or something. So in this sense, you're completely correct. It was the beginning of that end. But of course, looking back as a Russian, as a historical determinist, I would say, well, you know, we want it for the better, but it turned out to be like always.
Chernomyrdin will live forever for that. And I'd also like to point out, right, within 1 year after these events, we had loans for shares, basically the incredibly corrupt privatization program. Within 2 years, we had the Chechen War. So a lot of the things that – and we had – never mind the wave of assassinations, Listiev and everything. A lot of – I guess one of the reasons we say, did Russia lose its innocence, going back to, as I said in the beginning of the program, is because right after this, things did seem to go south in a lot of ways. But in any event, that is all we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from London has been co-host Kirill Kobrin, editor of the History and Sociology magazine, NZ. And also on the Skype line from New York City has been the co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And also joining us via Skype and also from New York City has been Nina Khrushcheva, professor of international affairs at the New School, director of the Russia program at the World Policy Institute, whose new book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind, will be published next spring. Thanks to all of you for an enlightening and stimulating discussion.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
I'd also like to thank our brilliantly patient and patiently brilliant producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my absolutely indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you once again, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. And join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.